Welcome to Family Policy Matters, an engaging and informative weekly radio show and podcast produced by the North Carolina Family Policy Council. Hi, this is John Rustin, president of NC Family, and we're grateful to have you with us for this week's program. It's our prayer that you will be informed, encouraged, and inspired by what you hear on Family Policy Matters, and that you will feel better equipped to be a voice of persuasion for family values in your community, state, and nation. Today we bring you part two of a keynote address delivered by Dr. Ryan Anderson of the Heritage Foundation at NC Family's Major Speakers Dinner in Charlotte, North Carolina on October the 8th. Dr. Anderson is the William E. Simon Senior Research Fellow at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C., and is a highly sought-after researcher, writer, and speaker on many of the most pressing issues facing our culture today. We hope you enjoy.
All right, so what would come next in this kind of concentric circle? We owe our children a life, the right to life, to protect their life, to welcome them into life. We owe our children a relationship with their mother and with their father. The next is that we owe our children an upbringing that reflects the truth about God. One of those next things that we would owe is to give our children a sound religious formation, to teach them truths about the Creator, about the Redeemer, about the Sanctifier, teaching our children truths about the most important things in life. And this is why the very first clause of the First Amendment to the Constitution deals with religious liberty. And yet what we're seeing in a host of areas is that the ability of families to form their kids in the faith and then to live out those faith commitments is being threatened. So let me just give you one example right off the bat is during oral arguments in Obergefell. So the Supreme Court case that redefined marriage, Justice Alito asked the Solicitor General during the Obama administration, what's going to happen to Christian schools that continue to teach that marriage unites husband and wife? Will they lose their nonprofit tax status the way that racist schools lost their nonprofit tax status? He mentioned the case Bob Jones University, a famous Supreme Court case in which a school, an evangelical school at the time that had a policy on no interracial dating, the IRS revoked their nonprofit tax status. And so Alito says, all right, if this Supreme Court redefines marriage, will the Obama IRS now revoke the nonprofit tax status of Wheaton College, of the University of Notre Dame, of Gordon College, of Regent, of Liberty? Just fill in the blank for your Christian school, and not just colleges, but K through 12. Maybe you send your kids to a private Christian day school. Maybe you send your kids to a private Christian high school. Will all of those schools now be on the wrong side of the government? And what the Solicitor General said was chilling. He says, I don't deny it, Justice Alito, that's going to be an issue. I don't deny it, it's going to be an issue. He could have said, of course not, Justice Alito. Racism is utterly different than Orthodox Christian beliefs about human sexuality. And so the Obama administration will never treat people who believe marriage unites man and woman the way that we treat racists, right? He could have said that. He could have tried to have a little distance between the bad outcome that he knew Alito didn't want to see him endorse. And instead he said, look, that's gonna be an issue. Had Hillary Clinton won the last presidential election, it would be an issue right now. There's no doubt in my mind, just given what the Obama administration was doing in its last months of office, that they were paving a way to pass the baton to the Clinton administration. Everyone assumed she was going to be winning the election. And Trump, his administration has been remarkably good on religious liberty. They've been undoing step by step by step all of the religious liberty violations that took place in the prior administration. If you think about this, religious liberty wouldn't even have been a main topic for a dinner discussion like this prior to the Obama administration. Can you think of any high-profile religious liberty violations during the George W. Bush administration? Or even for that matter, during the Bill Clinton administration? President Bill Clinton was the one who signed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act into law. And then when Indiana passed the same exact bill and Governor Pence signed it into law, the state gets boycotted. Just like your state got boycotted after HB2. The left all of a sudden has decided that policies that 10, 15, 20 years ago were common sense, bipartisan, unanimous policies, all of a sudden now you're a human rights violator. So one question will be, will you be able to educate your children in the faith? Will faith-based schools that teach the truth about marriage, that teach the truth about issues where the government has strayed from the truth, will they lose their nonprofit tax status? Will they lose their accreditation? What's good of going to a non-accredited college? Or put it this way, if you're under the age of 16, you have to go to an accredited school, either a state-run, government-run public school, or a private school or a homeschooling program that has met the state's standards for education. What then happens after you graduate and certain professions are closed to you? What if you can't become a doctor unless you're willing to perform abortion? Or you're willing to counsel same-sex couples that are having marital trouble? Or you're willing to turn men into women and women into men? We'll get to that a little bit later. But the religious liberty challenges facing the country, there's been a pause button that has been pressed during the past 2.5 years. It's not a stop button. It's not a rewind button. It's a pause button. And as soon as there's a hostile administration back in DC, you can expect all of these religious liberty cases to come back with a vengeance. Whether that deals with Little Sisters of the Poor, or the fact that they had to spend 8 years of their lives suing the federal government, the fact that the owners of Hobby Lobby had to sue the federal government, the fact that Wheaton College had to sue the federal government. Don't think that any of these cases are settled and done with forever. The Trump administration is settling these cases, but the next administration will have another hostile regulation, whether it comes from the Department of Health and Human Services or the Department of Education or the Department of Justice. And so we're going to need people. We're going to need lawyers. We're going to need policymakers. We're going to need lobbyists, activists pushing back on this. And it can come at both the federal level or the state level. So most of you are probably familiar with Jack Phillips, the baker. He was sued under a state law, right? A bad state law that said that he had to make custom wedding cakes for same-sex weddings. He was then tried under the State Human Rights Commission that was packed with a bunch of political appointees from a left-leaning administration. And during his own administrative hearings, they compared him to Nazis and to racists. They ridiculed his faith. That's why he won at the Supreme Court. He won 7-2 because the treatment that he had received under a state tribunal had been so biased that he even got two of the lefties to vote for him, right? This wasn't a 5-4 win at the Supreme Court. It was a 7-2. That could happen here. Right? This is what's at stake when you see North Carolina contemplating to pass a sexual orientation and gender identity law. Some of your cities have these laws, but statewide you don't, and you don't want to. What these laws do is they take sexual orientation and gender identity, they make it a protected class the way that race is a protected class. So just think of all of the ways in which it's illegal to run a racist business, as it should be. It's illegal to run a racist school, as it should be. It's illegal to be a racist lawyer, as it should be. And now plug in sexual orientation and gender identity so that if you believe we're created male and female and that male and female are created for each other, you're now homophobic or transphobic. You're going to be treated in law the same way as the racist. Right? That's what's at stake. That's what Jack Phillips was facing. So what we owe to the children is a way in which they can be formed in their faith and then live out their faith without government penalties. I want my son to grow up to love God and to live out his faith every day of the week, 24 hours a day, right? I don't want him to be the type of Christian that just goes to church on Sunday morning for 1 hour and says, all right, I checked the box for this week, right? None of us want that for our own lives or for our children's lives. We want them to be able to live out their faith at work, in their families, in their communities, in their charitable activities. And what happens when the government says no? The Green family, you can't live out your faith at work. The Greens are the owners of Hobby Lobby. Jack Phillips, you can't live out your faith at work. Little Sisters of the Poor, you can't even live out your faith in your own charity. Right? These people run nursing homes for the elderly as they approach death, and they were told, no, you have to pay for abortion and contraception. They're Roman Catholic nuns. Like, why do they need a contraception and abortion in their healthcare plans? Right? This was utterly to make a point. Right? The Obama administration was trying to prove a point about these sexual issues, that if you disagreed with them on these sexual issues, you were part of a basket of deplorables. You remember that phrase. I didn't create the phrase. There are many people who think that way about people like us. And it's a sad political reality, but that's going to be coming back in this coming election. Okay, last thing I want to say, and this is a kind of a new topic. The last time I spoke for John at one of these, it was probably 3 or 4 years ago, and I don't remember saying a word about this. And that's the new question of gender identity. I'm not even sure the phrase gender identity was on any of our radar screens 4 years ago. It wasn't until Bruce Jenner, as he was then known, went on 2020 for that 2-hour special and announced that he was becoming Caitlyn Jenner, that this really became kind of like a prime time topic. In fact, I think that was the first prime time interview devoted to transgender issues. And now today at the Supreme Court, a very important case involving Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, asking if the word sex in the Civil Rights Act means gender identity and transgender status. Right? There's a chance that you would have unelected judges just rewriting the law. Thankfully, with Kennedy retired and with Kavanaugh on the court, it seems much less likely that that would happen with the current Supreme Court justices than what might have happened 2 years ago. Both of Trump's picks, Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, have been outstanding, just from a purely jurisprudential perspective. But what's at stake here is that what we saw was that the LGBT activists, they knew they were going to win in Obergefell. They knew that they had Anthony Kennedy's vote. And so they pivoted from the LGB part of the acronym to the T part of the acronym. Right? For the past 20 years, we had a discussion about gay marriage. We've had debates about gay marriage. We knew what the LG and the B part of the acronym meant. And we never really had a discussion about the T part of the acronym. And then overnight, Bruce Jenner goes on national TV, and then the Obama administration issues a Dear Colleague letter telling every bathroom, every school in the country, that they have to do their bathrooms based on gender identity, they have to do dorm rooms based on gender identity, they have to do sports teams based on gender identity. Overnight, Loretta Lynch is suing your state because of HB2. Recall that the Obama administration sued the state of North Carolina because you said, no, we're going to keep it as biology, not subjective identity. That objective biology is how we're going to govern our public facilities, not someone's subjective identity. But this is when I first kind of started digging into the question, what does the gender identity part, the transgender part of the acronym, really mean? And this is when I was first really troubled, because I first encountered people who had transitioned and then detransitioned. And so I ended up writing a book about this topic, partly because after having done a book on the gay marriage debate and having done a book on the religious liberty debate, there was nothing left to lose. It's a very liberating feeling. Janis Joplin, when she says, freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose, there's actually a lot of truth in that statement. And so from my perspective, I was like, anyone who hates me, they can't hate me anymore. And the people who hate me already, this new book won't give them any more additional reasons to hate me. And the people who don't already hate me, this new book isn't gonna flip them on me. And so what I discovered is that the way that they're now treating children, so staying for a minute with the children focus, is a child as young as 2 or 3 years old, if they're consistent, persistent, and insistent, they're the opposite sex, should be treated as the opposite sex, given a new name, a new pronoun, a new wardrobe, have access to new bathrooms at school, play on the new sports team. And if you doubt that this is happening at those young ages, do Google searches for Washington Post and LA Times and 5-year-old transgender child or 3-year-old transgender child. You'll see these newspaper reports kind of the parents being proud of the fact that they have the youngest transgender child, which makes you question who's really driving this decision-making process.
You've been listening to Family Policy Matters. This has been part 2 of a 3-part series featuring Dr. Ryan Anderson, who delivered the keynote address at NC Family's annual Charlotte dinner on October the 8th. Be sure to tune in next week for part 3. To listen online and to learn more about NC Family's work to inform, encourage, and inspire families across North Carolina, go to our website at ncfamily.org. That's ncfamily.org. Thanks for listening, and may God bless you and your family.